Thanks, Nathan. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. The latest obstacle on the road to the $2.9 billion Red Line light rail project is a lawsuit filed by 25 plaintiffs who own 20 properties on North Fremont Avenue in the West Baltimore neighborhood of Poppleton. Plans call for a tunnel under their houses. The 14-mile project will run from East Baltimore out to parts of Baltimore County in the west. The plaintiffs filed suit in Baltimore City Circuit Court. They contend the plans for a tunnel have made their properties worthless. They're asking for $22 million in damages and an injunction to stop the state from going forward with the project. Brian Sears, the Daily Record's business writer, covered the lawsuit last week. He's with me in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Why did these property owners file?
Well, essentially, they're arguing that what the state has done in rerouting the Red Line and essentially changing the direction, putting it under their properties in this 300 block of North Fremont, essentially has rendered their properties valueless. They argue that it's effectively a condemnation taking and was done so in violation of at least one state law, 2006 bill, that they claim required the state to engage with them and have open discussions about the possible routes and how their properties might be affected.
Are they essentially asking to be bought out?
That's my read of the lawsuit. I mean, the lawsuit doesn't say that, but that is essentially how I read the lawsuit, given the amount of damages, except for the fact that they are also asking a judge to permanently enjoin the state from developing the Red Line project. So the other side of this lawsuit is they are effectively seeking to try and kill the transit project.
But they're focused entirely on their own properties. They're not making larger transportation arguments.
That's correct.
Like
they
that.
Are only focused on these particular properties, 20 properties in the 300 block of North Fremont.
The MTA, as you quoted them, was not formally commenting on the suit, which they say they haven't gotten a copy of. But Henry Kay, the Maryland Transit Administration's Executive Director for Transit Development and Delivery, did talk to our producer, Jamila Kay, about the process. She asked him why the Red Line's route or alignment was redrawn and what the differences are between the alignments.
The primary difference between the 2009 alignment and the one that we finally adopted in 2012 was tunnel versus surface, Fremont Avenue versus Martin Luther King, and underground station versus surface station. The idea of changing the alignment, you know, evolved gradually over a period of time between 2009 and 2012. And by the time we got to 2012, you know, we were fairly settled on this new idea as being technically better and also better meeting the expectations of the community as they had described them to us.
Brian, very briefly, help us visualize what he's talking about when he ticks off Fremont versus MLK, tunnel versus underground station versus overground station.
As I understand this, the original idea was to have this track along Martin Luther King, and it was going to enter the city closer into the downtown area, somewhere around Lexington Street. As they came to develop this, they began to look at some of the engineering concerns. There was a surface, the plans for a surface station that would have required some interesting engineering because of the traffic. And so they decided that it might be better to reroute it. They're going to bring the route actually along Route 40 and take the pick up the tunnel in the center of Route 40 and essentially mine out an underground station. In my discussions with Henry Kay, they seem to believe that this is a better solution and a more reliable solution in terms of the design.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Brian Sears, business writer for the Daily Record. We're talking about challenges facing the Red Line light rail project. As you mentioned, the residents alleged the state did not properly notify them of the new plan, but Henry Kay, MTA's executive director of transit development, told Jamila Kay that people were notified beginning in the spring of 2012.
In that time frame, in terms of public input, both a round of public open houses, and then also in the spring, and also a round of public hearings in the fall. And, you know, among many other topics, the change in alignment in that Poppleton area was part of that. in 2013, once we'd received final federal environmental approval, you know, we began a process of more detailed engineering, a process we call final design, and that, you know, comes in final engineering drawings that are the basis of an advertisement for a contractor to build the line. And part of that process involves contacting the owners of all the buildings along the tunnel alignment, because we want to make sure that we know that there's nothing surprising about that building, so you know we can look at it from the outside, and you know it appears to be a standard building with maybe a standard depth basement, but you know sometimes you're surprised. And so around that period of time, as part of that process, we contacted, you know, one by one, the homeowners, you know, west of Martin Luther King, including along Fremont Avenue, and asked if we could have access to their, you know, their basements, so we could sort of see what was down there. And I think that's the formal notification that the homeowners refer to.
Is there a legal requirement that MTA alert property owners?
Well, the legal requirement that the homeowners mention is there was a bill passed in 2006 that created an advisory committee that was supposed to do a lot of looking at this and report to the General Assembly, but also to work with the community to find out what their concerns and interests were. And what the folks that filed the lawsuit have essentially said is that, you know, while this system was created and MTA did in fact come out and meet with community residents, the one thing that didn't happen until they got to this final design phase was when they started to get letters that said you specifically are going to be impacted, and that's when they became aware. But at that point, the line had been rerouted and the die had sort of been cast on that, and they were really coming out to do the engineering phase and starting to, as Henry Kay said, to, you know, try to get a look at the properties to learn about the specific properties that were going to be affected.
So is the lawsuit alleging that MTA failed to follow a legal requirement, or simply that it was unfair to the
both.
Resident?
The short answer is both. They are claiming that they did not follow the law related to this 2006 bill that was passed, and also that essentially what the MTA did was surreptitious, and you know treated them unfairly, and that it's an unfair taking of their property.
In addition to this lawsuit, what other challenges face the Red Line?
Well, one of the biggest challenges is going to be this tunnel that they're constructing. You know, this is right now a $2.9 billion project. The largest portion of this is going to be more than a mile worth of tunnel underneath of Baltimore City. There's a significant amount of engineering that will have to go into this. They have to worry about water table issues in some areas around Fells Point. They have to worry about anchoring of the Galleria building. They're going to actually be apparently tunneling under a CSX tunnel. So this is a fairly significant project. And I think when you look at sort of the recent history of projects that involve tunneling underground, these things tend to get expensive. And nobody that I've talked to at this point believes that $2.9 billion is going to be the final cost of this project.
The Red Line and how much it costs came up before the Board of Public Works last week.
Yeah, ironically enough, the day before this lawsuit was filed, specifically in relationship to a condemnation issue, developer Mark Saperstein owns a building in the 100 block of Lombard where the state wants to put a ventilation shaft for this project. And they appraised the property at $240,000. He kind of dug his feet in. He wanted initially four times that. The state ultimately agreed to buy the property for $550,000, and that caused State Comptroller Peter Francho and State Treasurer Nancy Kopp to raise the question of why isn't the state looking at using condemnation and eminent domain more when they have these issues, because this is a public project. And essentially what they've gotten is that, you know, the State Transportation Secretary, Jim Smith, has said that they will look at that, as issues come up. But, you know, it's one of those things where you have a developer who got a pretty decent deal, more than twice the value of the appraised property, and these private property owners who are saying that the state is really trying to railroad them.
Is there any impact that the November election could have on the Red Line?
You know, that really remains to be seen. Anthony Brown has remained committed to these projects, although both candidates have talked about wanting to find a way to restore some of the local share of the Highway User Trust Fund. A lot of that's paid for out of gas tax, but the gas taxes that we've recently raised are going specifically to help offset the cost of the red line. So if we start to move money back to the locals, the question becomes, what's the effect on these larger projects?
So Henry Kay told us, may have told you too, that first construction activities are to begin in 2015. By 2016, major work would be underway and red line operations are slated to start. Operations are slated to start in 2022. Do you see this as a realistic timetable?
You know, I think that there's still a couple of hurdles there. I mean, most importantly, some of the federal funding that still has to come through. They haven't made some of their final determinations. My experience with smaller projects is that there are always delays. So I would expect that there will be delays. How significant, you know, is anybody's guess at this point?
Brian, I appreciate you bringing us up to date. Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Sears is the Daily Record's business writer. We have a link to his reporting on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Also there, a full list of the next of the MTA's open houses on the Red Line. And at that website, our extended interview with Henry Kay of the MTA, in which he describes the differences in the Red Line alignments and shares some of the feedback he's gotten from residents. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning, cutting a year off the four-year college experience. Stay with us on 88.1.
Producer Jamila Kay. Go to our website to learn more about a segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Thanks, Nathan, and this is Maryland Morning on WYPR. The average college graduate enters the working world with about $30,000 in student loans. There's been a debate about how to lower that number for years now. One argument, shorten how long it takes to earn a degree. Paul Weinstein proposes just that in a paper published this month by the Progressive Policy Institute, a think tank in Washington. He's director of the Johns Hopkins Graduate Program in Public Management and joins me on the line from his office in D.C. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me here.
And I should have asked, is it Weinstein or Weinstein?
It's Weinstein.
Of Weinstein. Okay. I was okay. Saying that until just now. So tell us, why do you think a three-year degree is the solution?
Well, they're basically because it's the only proposal out there that not only increases access to college and at our better institutions, but also provides financial relief to students. That combination, I think, is more effective than simply continuing to feed the beast and providing more and more aid that allows schools to continue to raise tuition.
Well, walk us through it. How would schools do this as you envision it?
Well, they could do it in a number of ways. That would include possibly offering maybe two summer semesters, extending the fall and spring semesters by a couple of weeks. They could extend class hours. They could also, quite honestly, cut back on the number of classes required to receive a degree. So there's a number of ways you could actually get there.
Yeah, that's part of what I wanted to be sure I understood. Are you talking about compressing the same number of courses students currently take or reducing?
It could work either way, and we would really leave that up to the schools under this proposal. That would really be determined by the schools and their accreditors. Right now, the schools that are sort of doing this voluntarily are basically what they're really doing is following one approach, which is really requiring the same number of courses, but requiring students to do it in a shorter amount of time. The problem with that approach is that that obviously is not particularly user-friendly to the students, and students are not really taking schools up on that option.
Well, and if that's the approach that's taken, if students are taking the same number of courses, won't they essentially be charged the same tuition, with the same number of credit hours?
No, because under this proposal they wouldn't be allowed to. So the federal government would actually say to schools, as we envision it at least, if you take a student with financial aid, you take a student who's getting subsidized loans, Pell Grant, they're taking advantage of the tax credits, you have to make 3 years the norm. But you can't charge students more than you're charging them now annually. So they would then get the 25% reduction. Going forward, we'd ask a commission of schools, students, the federal government, state and local representatives, because, of course, state and local governments actually provide a lot of financial support towards colleges and universities at the local and state level, to basically set forward a fee schedule going forward that would tie it to inflation plus some formula so that the savings would not simply be gobbled up in higher tuition increases going forward.
Well, as you pointed out, students... I mean, nothing, you didn't point this out, I'm saying, nothing is stopping students from graduating in 3 years now. And as you pointed out, very few students are choosing to do that.
Yes, because it's quite honestly, the schools do not make it very easy for them to do that. So what they're basically requiring students to do is, in fact, take six courses a semester or stay every summer and take additional courses. That's a lot of pressure on students. Plus, most schools don't offer necessarily the financial incentive. So if you're taking the additional courses, most schools will actually charge you. So if you want to go in the summer, they're going to charge you. So you're not actually getting that benefit. Now, there are a couple of schools out there that are moving to this. The most recent was the University of South Carolina, which is going to offer it again as an option. But until you actually move to this as the norm, where you basically say, hey, the right way to do this is in 3 years, not four, and we're going to make it easier for students to access that, you're not going to have a large take-up rate, and you're also not going to have the savings. The fact that we have four-year degrees is not because someone at the very beginning of time said, hey, it's best to go to college for 4 years. That's the ideal situation. It's really because of tradition we fell into it out of the four-year high school model. So there's nothing that says you can't do this in 3 years. And in fact, most of Europe is actually moving towards this. There's an agreement that was called the Barcelona Agreement, signed among EU countries, in which the European Union countries are basically moving to a three-year degree. In some cases, by the way, like in Germany, they're moving from 5 years to 3 years because they acknowledge the costs are rising and the recognition also that students actually, this is not the end of the line for their education. Most students are going on to grad school at some point. In realizing that, these countries are basically saying, 3 years is enough for college when we're asking them to do a year, 2 years, 3 years of grad school.
On WIPR, this is Marilyn Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Paul Weinstein, director of the Johns Hopkins Graduate Program in Public Management. He's written a piece for the Progressive Policy Institute, where he's a senior fellow advocating for a three-year college degree as the norm. You've been talking about 3 years versus a four-year degree, but practically, even a four-year degree is not attainable. Nearly 40% of Maryland college students don't graduate in 6 years. So you really seem to be bucking the trend of how college students are living their lives.
Right. Well, one of the reasons why they're taking 6 years is because of the cost of college. One of the biggest factors in dropout rates, for example, is the cost of college. Students get to college and they start paying their tuition and start seeing their student loans build up. And they kind of become overwhelmed by the whole experience. They either drop out or, in some cases, students go part-time because they can't afford it. And so they take a job on the side or take a job half the year so that they can take courses the rest of the time. We're actually seeing this even more so in grad school. I run a grad program here at Johns Hopkins, and 90% of our students are part-time. They work, and we therefore offer more of our courses at night and online in some cases, to accommodate those students that are working. If, of course, you are able to bring down tuition prices, you can help a lot of those students go through the system faster. and hopefully also keep some of those students from dropping out, because, as you said at the beginning of the show, the cost of college may be rising, but the fact is it's still financially beneficial to go versus not going.
This is not a new idea. You've given us some of the reasons why it may not have caught on with students sort of making it happen themselves. But as you pointed out, it is sort of the official route that universities are going in much of Europe, and I think also in Canada. So institutionally, why hasn't it caught on in the U.S.?
Well, I think one of the reasons in Europe is happening, and in Canada, is because there's a government push behind it. So in Europe, the European Union actually signed an agreement, as I mentioned before, the Barcelona Agreement. I think the other problem is that universities are very bureaucratic. Having worked in government and the private sector, nonprofits and universities, I can tell you the universities give government a run for its money in terms of not moving particularly fast and being very agile. So there's a lot of belief in tradition. There's a lot of belief in keeping things the same as they are. There's also the financial concerns. And so unless you have all schools moving this way, a lot of schools feel like they may be hurt by this financially. So the idea here is, of course, to let them increase capacity under this proposal so that most schools can stay financially whole over time.
Well, I appreciate you walking us through it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Paul Weinstein, he's director of the Johns Hopkins Graduate Program in Public Management. We have a link to his paper for the Progressive Policy Institute, his paper about the 3-year degree, on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. Just ahead, a new musical from Still Point Theater Initiative. Stay with us on 88.1. Producer Jamila Kay. Go to our website to learn more about a segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Everybody on 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us on this happy Monday morning. And coming up, we'll take a look at what the Orioles can expect in the American League Championship Series with the Kansas City Royals, as well as a look back to a particularly golden time in O's history. But first, theater critic J. Wynn Russick has a review of a new musical about some extraordinary women. The Still Point Theater Initiative's production of Vanishing Point is at a venue called Church & Company in Hamden. Here's Judy.
Aviatrix Amelia Earhart, evangelist Amy Semple McPherson, and mystery writer Agatha Christie were probably never in the same place at the same time, but they had several things in common. They were all early 20th century superstars, women making their mark in a man's world, and peculiarly, each disappeared for days or weeks, or in Earhart's case, forever in the 1920s and 30s. Their deep passions and unsolved disappearances are excellent material for the heightened world of musical theater. And Vanishing Point brings the three women together on stage with stirring results. The musical, created by former Baltimorean Rob Hartman and Leave Cummins, has been in the works for 2 decades. It is receiving a rousing Baltimore premiere by Still Point Theater Initiative. The opening number introduces the three protagonists and establishes their shared sense of adventure, spectacle, and mystery.
Vanishing the sea, vanished into thin air. It was an adventure. What a spectacle. Adventure, spectacle, mystery. Adventure, spectacle.
The music musical styles are tailored to the characters. For example, there's a touch of all-American folk for McPherson, though surprisingly little gospel, and a suggestion of British music hall for Christie, particularly when she leads the other two in a song about red herrings. Musical director Ben Shaver gets a robust sound out of Zoe Kantor as Christie, Nina Kaufman as McPherson, and Inez Nasara as Earhart. But at the preview I attended, Kantor and Kaufman tended to race through and obscure some lyrics and dialogue. Nasara, however, is a powerhouse as Earhart, whether acting or singing.
Vanity and gravity, it was pulled in two directions. Outward expectations, inner ambitions. I did what I do, I kept pushing through, and I let vanity behind. Vanity.
In the first act, each woman's story, though woven through the other two, is told separately. After intermission, there's a major shift in approach. The three women interact and band together, trying to make sense of their own disappearances. The interaction is as intriguing as it is unexpected. There is one fundamental problem. The first act focuses on the events leading up to the disappearances. The second act attempts to figure out why the women vanished. It's interesting background and conjecture, but we need more about the disappearances themselves, both facts and impact. Going missing made headlines. By now, however, the specifics, with the exception of Earhart, have drifted too far from the public consciousness to expect an audience to fill in the blanks. The three cast members also portray a slew of minor characters, ranging from the protagonist's mothers and husbands to reporters and fans. StillPoint's artistic director, Ryan Michael Haas, smoothly and swiftly guides them in and out of their numerous roles. Vanishing Point is being performed in a space called Church and Company, on the second floor of a former church in Hamden. The production's central scenic elements are three mirrors and three benches. Unfortunately, when one actress stands on the bench up front, she blocks the view of her fellow performers for some of the audience. Even so, this is an exhilarating show and production. StillPoint Theater Initiative was founded by Towson University theater grads 4 years ago. The company's name refers to the still point between breaths. In this case, it's extremely apt. There are times when Vanishing Point nearly takes your breath away.
Vanishing Point is at Church and Company in Hamden until October 19th. We've got a link to all the details at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Next Monday, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review Venus in Fur at Rep Stage in Columbia. And we'd like to make a correction to Judy's review last week of the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company's production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Two actors were misidentified in that review. Catherine Elizabeth Kelly plays Titania, and Scott Allen Small plays Oberon. We apologize for the error, and you've got one more week to catch A Midsummer Night's Dream, which closes on Sunday evening.
Something magic happens every time you go. You make the magic happen, the magic of Orioles baseball when the game is close.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. As you have undoubtedly heard by now, the Baltimore Orioles are headed to the American League Championship Series, which begins Friday at Camden Yards, when the O's start a best-of-seven series with the Kansas City Royals. They'll play Friday and Saturday in Baltimore, and they're scheduled to play Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday in Kansas City. If more games are necessary, they're back in Baltimore on Friday and Saturday, the 17th and the 18th. So this morning, a look at what lies ahead for the Orioles, as well as a look back at the halcyon days when the O's were one of the most dominant teams in Major League Baseball. I'm joined here in Studio A this morning by Maryland Morning sports guru Mark Hyman. He's a journalist and author who is currently on the faculty of George Washington University. His latest book is called Concussions and Our Kids. And Peter Hofberger joins us as well. He's the son of Gerald Hofberger. Hofberger family owned the Orioles in the 1960s and 70s when the O's made 4 World Series appearances in 6 years. Good morning to you both. Good to see you.
Good morning, Tom.
So, Peter, take us back to 1966, the first time that the Orioles were in the postseason. The only postseason that existed in those days was the World Series. They're in the World Series. They play the Los Angeles Dodgers, and they win in 4 straight games. You were how old at that time?
I was 9 years old.
And you were at the games at Memorial Stadium?
Yes.
What do you remember of those games and of that series?
Well, ironically, I remember, you know, that we won it in 4 straight, and there was a billboard that the advertising agency, WB Donor, which was located right across the street here, put up in great haste that said, "Would you believe 4 straight?" And, you know, I'd look at that billboard, and I still don't believe that we won it in 4 straight. I think that there are a lot of people still shaking their heads. But how appropriate that we're sitting here this morning having won 3 straight against 3 straight Cy Young Award winners.
Yeah, to get into to what now is the ALCS, the American League Championship Series. There's that famous photograph of Brooks Robinson leaping in the air to greet Dave McNally and Andy Etchebarren at the end of the 4th game of the sweep of the Dodgers. So I think a lot of people do remember that time, even if they weren't around or even if they were little kids. Did you spend a lot of time in the locker room, in the clubhouse with the O's at the time that your family owned the team?
I did. A few years later, I was lucky enough to get a summer job in the public relations department, which at that point consisted solely of Bob Brown and, during the summer, me. And so I was the guy who would run into the clubhouse and get a ball signed or something like that, often to placate a disgruntled fan, maybe somebody who had mustard spilled on them or something like that. They'd come into the office and complain, and we'd get them an autograph, send them on their way happy.
What's your recollection? One of the things your dad did was he was the guy who hired Frank Robinson.
Yes.
For the Orioles, who came in 60.
Well, he hired the guy who hired Frank Robinson,
right.
to be fair, because that was his style, to let the baseball men make the baseball moves.
Yeah. And in the obituary of your dad, who passed away in 1999, Frank Robinson was quoted as saying that your dad was always very warm, friendly, gracious, and always asked about his family and how his wife was doing. And it wasn't just a slap on the back and, you know, good game, pal.
Or what are you going to do tomorrow?
Yeah. Yeah. What's your recollection of the team in those days? Did you get to know the players as a little kid?
You know, the players were different. And, you know, Jim Palmer, for example, when, at least for a couple of years, when the season ended, he went to work for one of the family businesses. He was in the menswear department at Hamburgers, which was a men's clothing store on my mother's side of the family.
It was, and in 1966, he was the youngest member of the Orioles. He was 20 years old in that season. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And of course,
he outpitched Sandy Koufax.
So. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Where were your seats when you were in Memorial Stadium for the games back in those days? Where were you all sitting?
We were just to the home plate side of the Orioles dugout, which unusually in 1966, or at least for a home team, was on the third base side. Of course, right now it's on the first base side, and in most major league cities, that's the case. But if you'll recall, the sun would shine into the first base dugout. And so the Orioles moved from first base to third base. And we sat a little bit to the right of that.
A little geographic strategy.
Yeah.
Right? And there were some folks on that team that literally had the power to block out the sun. I mean, as a little kid, what was your reaction to a guy like Boog Powell? I mean, who just seemed enormous.
He was. And I'll tell you, I'll bring those two stories together about being in the clubhouse and the size of Boog Powell. But, you know, our family might have owned the team, but I was no more comfortable around them than anybody else was. I was awestruck by them. And one day when I was in the clubhouse getting a box of balls signed, standing there waiting for, I think it was Mark Belanger to sign these balls, I had no idea that this man, Boog Powell, who was, you know, 6'18" or something, 350 pounds, was down on all fours, putting a match between the sole of my shoe and the leather upper, and then lighting it, giving me the infamous hot foot, to the great delight of all, you know, the entire clubhouse. And that was my initiation, you know, when I started doing that Mexican dance. After that, I felt like I was part of the club. And that's the way that those guys operated.
Yeah.
They knew how to have fun. They knew how to welcome somebody in, how to loosen them up. And, you know, a lot of credit goes to Frank Robinson for being the judge of the Kangaroo Court. But they, you know, they were pranksters and you could have fun.
Yeah. What's your reaction to, or how do you compare your, this time in 1966 when you were just a little kid to the euphoria that everybody feels in Baltimore now? Of course, they won on the road yesterday, but you know, when they won their division, there was, mm-hmm. you know, that was thankfully at home. You know, they sweep the Tigers, as you say, three former Cy Young award winners, and we get past them all in grand fashion. How do you think it compares now to the 60s?
Well, I guess the easy answer is to say that, oh, it's all different and, you know, times have changed. But what you see out there this year is much like what you saw in the 1960s, other than the fact that there's so many more people at the games now. And, you know, that has made all of the difference. But each on an individual basis, I think they're just ecstatic now as they were in the 60s. There's a freshness, there's a newness. When you contrast it to what you saw out in Detroit, where, you know, maybe the fact that they've been in postseason ball for several years has made them complacent. Maybe it's the cold, who knows? But the excitement here is much like the excitement that we saw back when we were ruling the baseball world.
Mark Hyman, this is also interestingly, the 6th of October, 1991, was the last game played at Memorial Stadium. You were working for the Sun, and you accompanied the limo that took home plate from Memorial Stadium down to Camden Yards. What do you remember about that?
Yeah, that was an interesting assignment. I was covering all events around the construction of Camden Yards at the time, the politics and the economics of it and the actual construction of the stadium. So rather than actually cover the ceremony at Memorial Stadium, my job was to accompany the limousine that had rolled onto the field and home plate was put in the trunk, and it was headed down to Camden Yards for a ceremony there. So Paul Zwaska, who then was the groundskeeper for the Orioles, was dressed in a white tuxedo, and he dug up home plate with the help of a few other members of the grounds crew, and the limo rolled out of the stadium. I got in, and there we were driving downtown in a limo with home plate in the trunk. It was, so Paul and I, chatted on the way down, and we talked about how odd it was to be, we had this unusual cargo in the trunk. And when we got to Camden Yards, rather than haul this home plate out of the trunk, which had this big concrete slab attached to it, it must have weighed 75 pounds, Paul had one of these throw-down home plates that you get in the softball game and threw it down at home plate, and then that's how the ceremony began.
That was
so it was unusual.
Now, it's been since 1997 that the Orioles have had any postseason appearances. They are favored against the Royals. Royals are a pretty young team, and they've had a playoff drought that's even exceeds that of the Orioles.
Yeah, the Royals got into the postseason as a wild card team, so they did not win their division. They finished second, actually, to the Tigers in the Central Division, and they have just rolled through the playoffs. They beat Oakland in extra innings, then they beat the Angels, the team with the best record in the American League. They beat them three straight. The first two games were extra inning games as well, and they're playing their best baseball now. They're a team built, I think, on pitching and speed. And in one of the Angels games, they stole seven bases, which is a postseason record. So the Orioles will be tested.
Orioles certainly not known for their speed. They are known for their power ball. They hit more home runs than any other team in the league. The Royals hit fewer home runs than any other team in the league. But generally, the matchup is going to come down to pitching again?
I think so. You know, the Angels are a power-hitting team. Albert Pujols, Mike Trout, Josh Hamilton, three of the biggest sluggers in the American League, and they were totally neutralized by the Royals' pitching staff.
Mark Hyman is on the faculty of George Washington University. His latest book is called Concussion and Our Kids. Peter Hofberger's family owned the Baltimore Orioles from 1965 to 1979. The Orioles take on the Kansas City Royals in the first game of the ALCS on Friday. We've got a link to more information on our website. Come to wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Gentlemen, thank you to you both, and go O's.
Thank you, Tom.
Go O's.
Appreciate it. Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WIPR, in Baltimore. Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay produce the program. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. Payam Agagasam and Elizabeth Sherwood help out with production. You can listen to a live stream of Maryland Morning on any device. Come to wipr.org/listen. To catch shows that you might have missed, you can find a complete audio archive at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up Wednesday, I'll visit the Great Kids Farm, the working farm that is supplying food and instruction to kids throughout Baltimore City. I hope you can join us Wednesday morning on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.